Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready for you.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
The page came from your dad's office at the arcade. That number's been disconnected for 20 years.
Wow, that's, recent quote.
Yeah, that's a quote from a movie that hasn't even come out yet.
That's awesome.
Tron Legacy. But it actually pertains to what we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for once I actually said what the name of the movie was.
Sure.
Usually I don't do that.
Do you all know that every time he does that, he's actually quoting from a movie?
Or song.
Or song.
Yeah, sometimes it's a song.
That's true. Sorry.
Yeah. So yeah.
But usually a movie.
I'm waiting to get to the point where the listeners start to write in and tell me what I'm quoting from. We did give that challenge once.
Yeah.
So
I think he just did it for the subsequent episodes as
right.
well.
Right. Yeah. You need to go back and listen to it. I don't know when I started doing that, but yeah, make a list.
After you were doing the greetings from the world.
Yeah.
The world, different hello.
But moving on to anyway. Our actual topic, which is arcades, that again pertains to the quote I chose. We wanted to talk about kind of the rise and fall of the video game arcade.
Yes, indeed. I spent many, many quarters growing up in video arcades.
I started off spending many, many quarters, and then I shifted to spending many dollars to get tokens.
Yes.
Because that happened.
Well,
it was a great money-making scheme. Well, I guess we can talk about that, too, although that's kind of tertiary to the full discussion. So to really discuss the history of video game arcades, I need to cut off Chris just before he's about to say something. What were you going to say, Chris?
Well, I was going to launch into a whole thing, but go ahead.
Oh, no.
Go ahead.
No, please launch.
Okay. So, of course, many of you know that I am older than many of our listeners. But I grew up in a skating rink. My brother was really into roller skating
wow.
when I was a kid. No, but I mean, he spent a lot of time in roller rinks as a kid. And I remember, going back to the research, I remember a lot of the things that I've seen as seminal moments in video gaming. I remember the tabletop Space Invaders games.
Yeah.
And things like Gunfight and all these things, and just watching them go from, you know, the rack of video games pinball machines, you'd have four or five of those and maybe a couple video games. And then gradually they started squeezing out the pinball games. And suddenly there were arcades in the neighborhood where you could play all kinds of stuff like Joust and Robotron and Defender, Spy Hunter. I mean, you know, the kids growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, like me, you know, that was a big thing. We'd go down the arcade at all. As a matter of fact, I had a friend whose parents owned an arcade.
Wow.
And
now that's a score.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, every once in a while, they'd give me an extra dollar's worth of tokens. But but yeah, but that was the thing. It was like, you know, we'd spend quarters on them. And then, of course, the token thing was sort of a way to get more people involved. But, I mean, it was for a very long time. That was a great way to spend a summer afternoon when you're a kid.
Yeah. So I have a quick question for you.
Okay.
So when you were growing up in this skating rink.
Yes. With the pterodactyls flying around outside and all that.
Had they actually invented the wheel, or were you just kind of skidding along on shoes?
I don't like you very much.
So my point here is Chris is old. The arcade was kind of a growth out of the whole video game popularity boom, because arcades didn't just pop up as soon as arcade games popped up. It took a while.
No, they were in places like skating rinks and bars and restaurants. You'd see one or two games here and there, but there wasn't any arcade to put them in. I mean, back when we talked about pinball machines before, but there weren't any, you know, pinball machine arcades, at least not very many of them.
Right.
I think there were kinds of, same kind of places now where you have, you know, for example, skee ball and other kinds of things. But those are the kinds of things you'd find in, you know, amusement parks and things like that. They weren't really freestanding like the video game arcade of the 80s was.
Right, right. So the previous arcades would be things like at Coney Island.
Sure.
You go to Coney Island and they might have an arcade section, as in it's an area where there are games of skill, or sometimes not skill, that you could play. And it was a combination of that old mode of business, this idea of an area of entertainment, and then the fact that the video games that were popping up in places like bars and skating rinks and things like that were getting really popular. So it wasn't a huge leap for people to say, hey, what if I were to create a space a storefront space and just fill it with these arcade games, and then my business will just be having people come in to play the games.
Yes.
And the arcade was born, the video game arcade, we should say. I mean, I keep on having to specify because arcade, the word arcade's been around for much longer.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny. Any of you who have had the moment when you realize that a song that you really like is a cover of a song that is very old, or, you know, decades old, in fact, and you sort of have that feeling of regret and let down, you know, oh man, I didn't realize that somebody else actually did this song. I had the same moment when I, you know, went to get my hair cut in an arcade and I couldn't figure out what the games were.
I had that and same experience.
And I was going, come on, where are the games? It's an arcade. It's like, no, actually, that's not literally, video game and arcade are not necessarily synonymous.
Right, exactly. Yes, I had the same experience because I also grew up in the 80s. Both the wheel and the fire had been around for a while when I was a kid.
Seriously.
So, yeah, they started popping up in the 70s in the earliest days of arcade games. So we're talking about things like Pong and Space Invaders.
Sure.
Galaxian, that kind of thing. They got more popular as more video games started coming out. And for a while, there was a little worry among arcade owners that the video game home market could make an impact on arcades. But the early video game home market was really limited. Normally your graphics and your sound and everything that you got out of a home video game console, and we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s here, just could not compare to what you could get in an arcade, like a video game arcade. The games would be more sophisticated in the arcade than they were in the home market. Also, the style of games was totally different. And it you have to think of this from a business standpoint for it to really make sense. Arcade video games, so the ones that you would actually find in these places, were designed to be really intense and fun, but last for a relatively short time span, like any individual play session.
You have hit on the crux of the problem.
Yeah?
Yes, you have.
So If I go into an arcade and I want to play a video game, that game has been built, has been designed with the experience in mind that it should be fun and challenging, but it should also not last very long, because otherwise you can't make money, right?
Yes.
Because, I mean, it's a per-play, a pay-per-play model. So that means that every time you play the game, you're paying some money. It's not like it's a time-based model. Like, if arcades were more of a you pay a certain amount of money and then you get unlimited plays for an hour, it would be a totally different story right now.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was a pay-per-play system, it meant that you had to keep the plays at a short time span or else you lost money. Because you'd have a kid plunk one quarter into a game and then stand there all day playing.
That's right. Yes, I was the ideal video game customer. Because I came in and dropped, you know, $6 worth of quarters in there in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, it doesn't take long if you are not particularly adept, or if the game is designed to be really, really hard, or in some cases the game's just plain unfair.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's, there's, yeah.
Well, you can, and there were some that would allow you to allow the game owner to set the complexity of the game.
Yeah, you could make it where you could set the difficulty level for some games. And of course, once games started to include the continue feature, that was a real boon as well, because it meant that you could coax the player into spending more money to keep the experience going without losing all the progress that he or she had made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of funny though, but yeah, that's exactly the point. I mean, if you've got an arcade full of video games, and you've got a steady stream of people coming in to plunk quarters down, or you know, even more for some games, depending on the situation. Then you basically have a semi-captive audience, and anything you know, you have the video game level set maddeningly difficult. You know, where people just go, I'm going to try it again, and drop another quarter in there, or the continue game feature. Well, then you certainly do that. And the multiplayer games where you had, you know, two, three, four people getting involved in a game.
Yeah, that's where you get the social aspect, which was something else that home video game systems were not terribly good at. I mean, you had a lot of the early home video game systems were designed for two players,
mm-hmm.
but that was as much as you could get. And it's difficult to have a group of people over to play games where only two people can play at the same time, because people are always waiting for the next turn.
Mm-hmm.
In an arcade, you had variety, so people could go and play other games, while if their favorite game was occupied, they could either wait or they could play something else.
Yes.
Home video games, not so much. In fact, early home video games, and we'll probably talk about this in another podcast, some of the early consoles were limited to four games hard-coded on the console itself.
Ah, yes.
So, this was before the cartridge.
Four? I'm sorry, did you say four?
Before.
Oh, okay.
Four games, yeah.
Because I have one that only had three.
Right, right. Some of the earlier ones had even fewer. But at any rate, so the arcade had the advantage over there in the social aspect for a really long time.
Sure.
Right? And it had the advantage of graphics and sound for a really long time. But eventually, the home market started to catch up.
Yes.
And on top of that, players began to divide up into two camps. You had the people who really like the arcade experience in the sense of the kind of games that have that really intense but short time frame.
Mm-hmm.
The video game market at home, you could create games that lasted a really long time, had a really extended experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because you've already paid for the game, right? I mean, you went out and you plunked down $50 for a video game. Whether you play it once or whether you play it forever, that you've already poured all the money you're going to into that game.
Right.
At least until we get to downloadable content, which was much further down the road. So at that stage, you could go ahead and design a game for players that would be very, you know, an extended experience, mm-hmm. something that you can't get in an arcade without sacrificing profit.
Yes.
And then as players began to value that experience, they stopped going to arcades as much. And so the arcade attendance began to suffer. And that's when it's also really expensive actually to maintain an arcade.
Well, talk about the cost, the relative costs again. I mean, you have, let's say I'm making up a generic console, home console game. You spend, say, $300 for the console mm-hmm. and about $50, $60 for a game. And that's expensive. I mean, to get started, when sure. you're first buying a new console, I mean, if it's something like, you know, a brand new Xbox or PlayStation, you know, when it first comes out, it could be $600, $700 for yeah. a new machine. Still, one stand-up coin-operated arcade game is much more expensive than that.
Yeah, especially if it's new.
Yes.
Or, paradoxically, some of the older ones as well, because they become collector's items.
Indeed. So, I mean, and that's just one game. If you're trying to, you know, pay rent on an arcade space every month, pay employees, which is going to be one of your largest items on the budget anyway. I mean, right. staffing. And then you have to pay for the electricity to run all these electronics in your establishment. Mm. You have to get people in, and they're dropping in a quarter at a time. I mean, that's why, you know, the economics of it are just so bad, unless you have people thronging through the doors. And that's why I think, that's a big thing that had a lot to do with the rise in cost of the video games. I remember going back into an arcade into the 90s, you know, after dropping quarter after quarter in the games before, and then finding that a lot of them were at least 50 cents to play, if not a dollar.
Right.
And you're going, you know, I can't afford to, you know, play more than four or five games at a time.
Yeah, it ends up...
Yeah, it's expensive.
And you can see that reflected in the way arcades started to change strategies and how to charge customers. When we talked about the tokens thing,
yeah,
really the tokens come down to you spending more money than you normally would. Because if you put a dollar in a change machine and you get four quarters out, there's no guarantee that you're going to spend those four quarters at the arcade. You may just be using that change machine. You might play one game and then you walk away with 75 cents.
Right.
If you get tokens, you can only use it in the arcade.
And a lot of times they would use little techniques like, you know, if you put in a dollar, you get four tokens. But if you put in $5, you know, maybe they'll throw in an extra dollar's worth of tokens.
Yeah, so you get like 24 tokens instead of 20.
You know, so it entices you to spend even more cash at the arcade itself.
Yeah, because they're just selling time on machines. They're not. Yep. There's no loss for them to throw in some free tokens.
No.
Then you have establishments like Dave and Buster's that uses mm-hmm. a card-based system where you're buying credit and the credit is put on a card and then you slide yes. the card in the games. This is brilliant because now you've reached the point where you've removed the value from the game itself. Like unless you're really good at doing math in your head, it's really hard to establish how much money each per play is costing you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you put in $20, you get $20 worth of credit on your card, and it's transferred into points, and then each game is worth a certain amount of points. Unless you're like doing that conversion in your head, you're not thinking, hey, this is costing me $1.25 per play or something like that.
Right.
And I just pulled that number out of thin air. So
sure.
Yeah, that was just an example.
We know.
Yeah, as I always do. Why?
Well, we have to do that sometimes to set up an example. So,
right.
You know,
right.
That's an example.
So those were some ways of arcades trying to extend their lifespan, and some of them are still around, like Dave and Buster's. Of course, you can find those locations around the United States. Excuse me. Had a little hiccup there.
And, of course, those cards are reloadable, so you could bring it back next time you come.
Yeah, you can actually use them in different locations, too.
Yeah, see, that's another enticement there
yeah,
to try
because,
to get you back.
Yeah, as opposed to the tokens, which might only work in one arcade, if you go to a franchise, you might be able to transfer those credits toward another game system, although that's not necessarily seamless. I experienced a problem when I visited Philadelphia mm-hmm. and went to a Dave and Buster's and tried to use my Atlanta Dave and Buster's card, and the person behind the counter, because I was actually going up to the counter at that point, the automated systems were full, looked and said, something's weird here. It's telling me that you're from Atlanta. Like, that's not weird. That is where I'm from. Are you calling Atlanta weird? I mean, I'm not going to be mad. I'm just wondering what you're basing that on. And we got into this big philosophical discussion, and I didn't get to play my skee ball. But that's a story for another podcast.
Skee ball. That's actually a good point.
Oh, about how arcades would try and differentiate themselves from the home market?
Yes. One of the things that I read that that may also have played a smaller role in the decline of the in popularity of video games, or at least the video game arcade, is that a lot of the organizations now that still maintain a lot of video games and other kinds of amusements like that, they switched to a ticket reward system.
Right.
So, and a lot of video games didn't offer that. I mean, you didn't see, you know, Trog pumping out tickets.
It's hard to compete with the home video game market today because home video games are so sophisticated.
Yes.
Right? So if you go and get a PlayStation 3, an Xbox 360, a Wii, or a really, you know, a decent gaming computer,
yeah,
you can run games that are phenomenal, that are really deep, rich experiences, that have amazing graphics, mm-hmm. you know, and can have hours and hours of gameplay to them. Whereas arcades just can't compete with that experience. So one of the ways that they get around that is by offering these amusements, these games of skill or chance or whatever that reward you for playing with tickets. And then, of course, eventually you can trade the tickets in to get something. For example, a friend of mine, who I will not name, played these enough at a Dave and Buster's to get an Xbox.
Wow.
Yeah. If you've ever looked at the points needed to get some of these big ticket items, they're astronomical. So you sit there and you start doing the math, like, all right, how many plays of various ticket winning games did he have to go through in order to buy, essentially, you know, to trade the tickets in to get an Xbox? And I wonder how many actual consoles he could have purchased with the money that he spent, you know, buying credits so that he could play those games.
Well, you know, people are likely to do that. I wasn't going to say that.
Yeah, he's stupid.
Oh.
He doesn't listen to this show. I'm all right.
All right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that they were trying all kinds of things at one point. I mean, hey, there was this game that you could dance on, and there were different colored pads on the floor, and you could, you know, match the stuff on the thing, and you couldn't do that at home except when they brought it home.
Yeah.
So, well, and, you know, it's
and see, that's, but
migrating.
That's, those are the kind of games you're going to see at arcades now. They're sure. The games that tend to be bigger immersive experiences than things that you typically will see at home until the next big innovation. Like, until Kinect comes out or the next generation of consoles come out where you can kind of simulate the arcade experience even further in your own home, the way that arcades differentiate themselves is through these games like the Dance Dance games and the racing games where it's a
where you actually
full
sit,
cockpit.
Yeah.
And you're usually racing against other players. Or there are a lot of light gun games.
Sure.
Lots and lots of those, because these are experiences that are not as easily replicable at home.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly that helps differentiate them from the home video game market and gives you a reason to go in there and play these games. But as the home market gets more sophisticated, that spells more trouble for these arcade systems. It also is what makes old fogies like me and Chris cry when we walk into an actual arcade establishment that still exists. Because while most of them died out, not all of them did.
No, nope, they're still around.
Some of them are still around. But when you walk into one and you're an old timer, you kind of get upset because you look around and you're like, well, all the games here are the same. They're all either racing games, dance games, or gun games. Like, where's the rampage? Where's the elevator action? Where's the Pac-Land? Yeah.
I want to play that new Pac-Man game that you saw at CES.
Oh, the four-person simultaneous Pac-Man game.
Which is only available in an arcade version.
Right. Yeah.
But if you are an old fogey like us and you're interested in catching up on some, you might check out this one place I read about in an article on the Christian Science Monitor by Ethan Gilsdorf. Up in New Hampshire, there is the American Classic Arcade Museum, and there's nothing, and there is, it's over an arcade, but no machine in there is newer than 1988. So it sounds like a lot of fun for those of us who are into that kind of thing.
There were some good games made after that, too, but...
Sure, but this really, is the classic stuff.
Yeah, really, the arcade didn't truly start suffering until about the mid-90s, which is when you started seeing some of the more advanced home consoles start to come out at that point. The NES and Super NES didn't take a huge chunk out of the arcades until much later, and, like I said, until the mid-90s. So But yeah, there are plenty of great games that were made 88 or earlier. Discs of Tron, Elevator Action, Spy Hunter, fantastic games. So yeah, that's kind of the story between about the rise and fall of arcades. I mean, like I said, we could still find a few of them scattered here and there, but they aren't as omnipresent as they seemed to be in the early 80s. I mean, it used to be that you couldn't walk into a shopping mall without finding at least one arcade.
Oh,
and
there
were some malls I went into that were big enough to have two.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. And they were always packed with people, too.
Yeah, and you know, there's certain experiences that you just can't get. Like, you can play on Xbox Live, you can play against other players, which is fantastic. And other game systems support similar competitive or cooperative gameplay online. And that's fantastic. It's still not quite the same as lining up to an arcade console and or arcade cabinet, rather, mm-hmm. and plunking a quarter down on the screen to mark that you have the next game.
Yep.
As two people are battling it out in Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter or something like that.
Yeah, I remember when people used to put a quarter up on the screen glass to let you know that
yes.
they had next game.
Yeah, I remember. So let's wrap this up with. Do you have any like favorite arcade stories at all? I have one I can tell if you want to think of one.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay, so I attended a science fiction convention in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It probably would have been in the early 90s, maybe, mm-hmm. and. Sadly, one of the biggest attractions at this tiny, tiny convention was a copy of Gauntlet 2 that was in their little game area for the hotel. It was the hotel's uh-huh. arcade machine. And one of the convention guys decided that it would be fun to go ahead and invest and get tons and tons and tons of quarters. I know that some people hate me using the phrase tons of stuff. But anyway, lots of quarters, and allow people to play this game as long as they wanted to. So I got in on level one and played Gauntlet 2 with three other people until we got to some ridiculous level, like in the hundreds. And that was one of the most fun experiences because it was just, again, you've got four people working together. They're cooperating, trying to play through this game, and you know the jokes that come up as people accidentally do things like shoot the food. If you've ever played the Gauntlet games, it has some very distinctive phrases that come out as you play, like you know, warrior, shop the food, elf, your life force is running out, wizard needs food. Badly. So yeah, that just ended up becoming a great community experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really have a story like that so much, but I do remember going to my friend's parents' arcade, and you know, I was pretty much guaranteed to see somebody I knew there, which was really cool. And then I used to go to this one pizza place all the time when I was a kid, and my parents would just, you know, give me $5 to play until the pizza showed up. And you know, there was always something good. Marble Madness, Spy Hunter, Tapper.
Marble Madness. Wow.
Yeah.
Good games.
That was the first time I encountered Dragon's Lair.
Yeah.
And you know, trying to figure out the sequence of moves that would get you to the next level. And
yeah, I finally got to see a laser disc of Dragon's Lair, which showed how to go through the whole game and win at the end. And then after it ran through that, it showed all the ways you could die.
Wow.
Yeah. The different ways you could die part was about three times longer than the actual gameplay part. It's definitely one of those experiences that's kind of sad to see it go away. But at the same time, financially, it's hard to justify operating an arcade. It's just really challenging to do it in a way that will make enough money to pay all the bills, much less turn a profit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's challenging.
I'd still like to find that cow milking video game that you were talking about.
Go to Japan, dude. We should also add that this is really only true necessarily in North America. There are other places where arcades are still going strong, and Japan is one of those places. You can go to Japan, and there are plenty of different arcades, and they have really innovative games, and sometimes they're really crazy, like a Milk the Cow arcade game, where you actually milk the electronic udders of a big plastic cow.
But it was basically like Simon, right?
Yeah, it looked like that's what it looked like to me. I didn't work up the courage to actually play it because I was certain that video of me playing it would show up online later. And sadly, that particular arcade no longer exists. Aww. International Bowl and Arcade off Buford Highway, I miss you.
Just goes to show you, if you get the opportunity to play an unusual coin-operated video game, play it.
Seize it. Seize that opportunity.
By the udders.
Dude, did you ever play any of the arcade arm wrestling games?
No.
Okay, we'll get into that later.
Okay.
If any of you guys have any questions, comments, topic suggestions, anything like that, you can write us. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, and Chris and I will arm wrestle you again really soon.
If you're a Tech Stuff fan, be sure to check us out on Twitter. TechStuffHSW is our handle, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechStuffHSW.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.